WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The 2022 Nobel Prizes will be announced in just a few weeks. Almost a year ago, our next guest received the call and thought perhaps someone was pranking him, that he was being awarded the 2021 Nobel Prize for Literature. After all, Abdulrazak Gurna had been writing for a long time, having published the first of his 10 novels in 1987. So now at 73, he's being recognized in a new way, so much so that his 2020 novel, Afterlives, has now been released in the U.S. Set in the early 1900s in a coastal town colonized by the Germans, the story follows four main characters, Khalifa, Ilyas, Afia, and Hamza, and their different backgrounds and relationships to the occupying German power, all while they try to live life. The New York Times says of the book, quote, "Afterlives is a celebration of a place and time when people held on to their ways, own ways, and basked in ordinary joys, even as outside forces conspired to take them away." Joining me now to discuss the book Afterlives, which is available now in the U.S., is Nobel Prize-winning author Abdulrazak Gurna. Abdulrazak, nice to meet you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
The story is set in the early 1900s in coastal town in what was then called by colonizers German East Africa, in a region that would be fought over in the British during World War I. What was something in your research for this book that was really valuable to you and really affected the way the stories, affected the stories you wanted to tell?
Okay. Well, I mean, it began before the research. It began with stories that I was hearing when I was growing up, because we were living, you know, alongside this area that right about here. And so we grew up with stories of that war, even though it was some decades after the war. And in some ways, there were no Germans anymore, because the Germans lost their colonies. So they had become myths, and their ferocity and their whatever. So the war was already something mythic and very, very interesting, therefore, to a child growing up and to us growing up. So that's the first thing. The first thing was that these were stories that were around. But then throughout a kind of lifetime of teaching and working mostly in the post-colonial literature area, that it was possible to read a lot of things to do with that experience of colonialism of all kinds, both, I mean, the British, the French, the Germans, etc. So, but then there is another kind of research, which is to do in a very, very focused way when you're getting close to writing the book. And then I just read a great deal. Yeah.
I want to circle back to that idea of the mythology around it. As a kid, as a child, what was something in the mythology that as an adult you realized maybe wasn't exactly true, but was part of a good story?
Yeah, well, the ferocity.
Yeah.
The stories of German ferocity. What I realize as growing up is that, in fact, almost all colonial encounters are violent in one degree or another, or at one time or another, and some continuously so. You have to remember, for the Germans in Africa anyway, it was only a 30-year experience. They only got their bit of Africa after the Berlin Congress divided up Africa. That was 1884. So it was that 30-year period of trying to establish their rule. And they went in as conquerors rather than in some other way that other colonial countries went in first as traders, and then as they get stronger, they take more control and so on. So I think it was a peculiar kind of experience for them and very violent. So all we heard really was this ferocity that, oh God, they did this, they did that, they did the other. And you realize later, as I say, that in fact they were all like that in one way or another.
I would love if you would read a passage from your book for our sure. listeners. That'd be wonderful.
Of course, yeah. This is the opening of the book. Khalifa was 26 years old when he met the merchant Amur Biashara. At the time, he was working for a small private bank owned by two Gujarati brothers. The Indian-run private banks were the only ones that had dealings with local merchants and accommodated themselves to their ways of doing business. The big banks wanted business run by paperwork and securities and guarantees, which did not always suit local merchants who worked on networks and associations invisible to the naked eye. The brothers employed Khalifa because he was related to them on his father's side. Perhaps related was too strong a word, but his father was from Gujarat too, and in some instances that was relation enough. His mother was a countrywoman. Khalifa's father met her when he was working on the farm of a big Indian landowner, 2 days' journey from the town, where he stayed for most of his adult life. Khalifa did not look Indian, or not the kind of Indian they were used to seeing in that part of the world. His complexion, his hair, his nose, all favored his African mother. But he loved to announce his lineage when it suited him. Yes, yes, my father was an Indian. I don't look it, eh? He married my mother and stayed loyal to her. Some Indian men play around with African women until they're ready to send for an Indian wife, then abandon them. My father never left my mother.
That was Abdul Razak Gurna reading from his novel, Afterlives. What is important to Khalifa when we meet him? What's important to him as a person?
Well, he's a man who doesn't like to show that he's kind. He puts on this manner of gruffness or whatever, but it's quite clear that he's a social creature. He loves talking, he loves meeting people, going to the cafe, gossiping and so on, and that kind of thing. For me, he's important in the book because he becomes the person who actually makes it possible for the other two main figures, both to survive in a sense, not in a big way, but in a small way. But it makes it possible for them to find a place of safety in the first instance, and also then brings them together, or allows them to come together. So I guess in some respects you might think of him as somebody who represents the best in the community, the best, the way in which communities can be generous and can support other people.
Afia was given away by her parents when she was a baby. They were poor and they were sick. What does her character teach us about how women were viewed at this time?
In the first instance, of course, she's a child. First, as a child, you have to see how children are neglected or can be neglected. Not all children, but children where parents have no... they're ill, as you say, they're poor. Mm. And so she's orphaned very, very early. And then, so as a child, she's already an oppressed person because she doesn't have the kind of support she should have. But then she's also a girl child. And so that's yet another difficulty that she has to grow up with. And very, very quickly, she finds out that there are certain things girl children are not allowed to do, which is like being able to write, for example. In my thinking, there were two people, Afia and Hamza, mm-hmm. And both of them, for different reasons, both of them are first traumatized as children and then go through a traumatic life. So my idea was this: how is it that people manage to retrieve something from such trauma or from these difficulties, which I think we do, and many people do. So it was a way of trying to reflect on or to demonstrate or dramatize that way in which people refine themselves, discover themselves, and somehow retrieve something of themselves, or indeed make something new. So that's why afterlives, second lives in a way.
Afia's brother, Ilyas, was taken from his family as a boy by the colonizing German army, raised on a German farm. How is Ilyas thinking about his identity in this novel?
Well, a lot of the experiences of colonialism produced people who admired the colonizers in one way or another. Either they admired their modernity, what they were bringing that was new, or they admired the way that they opened up the world in a way to new experience, adventure. They perhaps were drawn also to the prestige of power and all of these things. But suddenly, as a phenomenon, it's quite a common thing to find colonized people embracing the values, the habits, the culture of the colonizers. It could be that this is also to do with a certain kind of thoughtlessness on their part, but not always. In some cases, I suspect it was because they seemed to be offering another way of looking at things, which seemed more attractive than what they were used to. Of course, from our position, or from later on, or from when it became clear what the real point of colonialism was, then this seemed like treachery to oneself. And quite, of course, from where we are now, when ideas of identity have become kind of consolidated in a way that they would not have been at the time, people, for example, probably did not think of themselves as Africans, but thought of themselves as something more specific or more particular than that, or did not think of themselves as Tanzanians or Kenyans, because there was no Tanzania or Kenya. There were perhaps Kikuyu or Wachaga or whatever it might be. And so maybe it didn't seem like as much treachery as it might seem now. For whatever reason, we know for sure that there were many people, many communities that somehow invested something in colonial cultures that they themselves wanted to be like them. So Ilyas is an example of somebody like that.
And you mentioned Hamza. Let's make sure we get a chance to talk about Hamza. He is an ex-soldier, serves for the colonial army. How does Hamza's experience in the military change him after he returns home?
Yeah, well, it's always puzzling to me when you think about the way so many people, so many African people, became mercenaries in colonial armies and think, well, why did they do that? Well, probably complicated reasons. Well, one of those reasons will be the reason Hamza does it, which is out of desperation to escape the situation that he's in. And he thinks, being young, he probably thinks that joining the army might be a kind of opening up or adventure even. And he realizes the mistake that he's made. But I don't know how many people would have realized their mistake after joining such armies. But in any case, I can only follow this one. And this one goes through the experience of the war, is wounded, and then returns to the town that he used to live in. Again, like I mentioned a moment ago, my thinking was, how then does somebody like that, wounded, traumatized, how does he find some way of keeping on, as it were, of going on, of continuing?
My guest is Abdulrazak Gurna. We are talking about his latest novel, Afterlives. I do want to ask about the Nobel Prize win. We actually have a clip from the lecture you gave, the speech, when you touch on why you chose to write as a means of remembering your hometown and what done to its people by colonizers. Let's take a listen.
Many years later, I walked through the streets of the town I grew up in and saw the degradation of things and places and people who live on, grizzled and toothless, and in fear of losing the memory of the past. It became necessary to make an effort to preserve that memory, to write about what was there, to retrieve the moments and the stories people lived by and through which they understood themselves. it was necessary to write of the persecutions and cruelties which the self-congratulations of our rulers sought to wipe from our memory.
How do you hope your writing will help people better understand colonization?
You write with the with whatever kind of truthfulness you can manage, and also with whatever kind of desire to make something beautiful and attractive and interesting. But that's all you can do. You hope to achieve that. I don't have, you know, kind of like definite cast iron methods that would say this will do it. You put it out there and you hope that people will engage with it and say, yes, that's interesting, yet, yes, I knew that all along, or indeed, no, I didn't know that, and now I do.
Before you became a novelist and a professor at University of Kent, you were a secondary school teacher, is that right?
Yes, I was. Yes, for a couple of years, yeah.
What did you teach?
Oh, I taught English. I taught English and a bit of drama.
And what from that experience stays with you now that you, as you write still?
That it was good to move on. Well, the chance to move on came along.
So what has life, I mean, this is such a basic question, but there are very few people who can answer it. What has life been like for you since winning the Nobel Prize?
Well, it's been very, very good in the sense of being received and being recognized and the work reaching people now, people wanting to be reached by the work, new editions, new language editions, I mean, as well as the earlier books and so on. Everything about that is terrific. It's wonderful. And of course, just in any case, the recognition and the award. So absolutely wonderful. There's no question about it. It also means, and this is part of the deal, I suppose, it also means that you have to do a lot of talking, meet a lot of people, like speak to somebody like you a lot, which is fun, which is fine. I'm not complaining, you understand. But it does take a lot of my time, especially with new editions coming out. It means that as new editions, sometimes in different languages and so on, and they quite rightly want to speak to me, to interview me, for me to meet their readers or to hear from me anyway, for their readers to hear from me. So it's been like that mostly. But as you mentioned earlier, when you began, there'll be a new announcement in a few weeks. So.
You'll get some rest.
So there might be a little reprieve.
My guest has been Abdulrazak Gurna. The name of the novel is Afterlives. It is out now. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure.